It's really wonderful to be here. It's great to be in Ann Arbor always. I have to confess that I came here via East Lansing, but I made it. About 30 years ago, I was a student here at the university, and I'd like to dedicate my talk to my honors English professor, Lem Johnson, who was from South Africa. And at the time, I remember sitting in his class, and he said to us, "You've all been Mishigamu'd." And I was really confused by what he said. And I then proceeded to dig into some of the content that he was giving to us, which was about the Native American people that called this land home, and the names of which we continue to use without really understanding what those names meant to the people who created those words and those sounds for this place. And so it took about 30 years to really penetrate that and to figure out what was he really talking about, these tribal lands and the people that belonged here, and what are their stories of this place. Now, if you've been to northern Michigan, I live in northwest lower Michigan, so in Harbor Springs, which is below the bridge, there's a very strong presence of the tribe up there. And it's hard to go out underneath the night sky on land that you know was very sacred to them and tell their stories. So typically, I don't. But I recently had an encounter with a tribal member up there around an exhibit of the War of 1812, and that opened a door. So tonight I'm going to talk about some of those things relative to the work that I do up at the Headlands, and then also some of the stories from the night sky and then what's happening right now in the night sky. So as Amy shared, I am the program director for the Headlands International Dark Sky Park. And a dark sky park is an area of land over which the night sky has been protected from light pollution and light trespass. And this is a big issue because in the United States, the estimate is that almost two-thirds of the residents of the U.S. now live where they can't see the stars of the Milky Way at night. And this is being caused by the fact that almost one-third of all of the light that's used at night is spilling up into the night sky where it's not needed, amounting to almost a waste of almost $2.2 billion a year. It's not just money that's being wasted, it's resources, it's energy, and then it's also having a very damaging effect on nocturnal habitat, and then also on human circadian rhythms and our sleep patterns. And sleep disorder is related to almost every major health illness for the human being. So it's a really, really big issue. And while it's wonderful to have a dark sky protected place so we can get out in the dark and look at the sky, it's also good to think about that in really light polluted areas. How can we affect change? So I love to tell the stories of the night sky. It's how I use my English literature degree from the University of Michigan, but also I like to raise awareness about that issue. And the first thing you can do is just go home and look at the light that you have and see that it's being used in the proper way. So with that, I'd like to start by saying Happy New Year, because in the Anishinaabe understanding, and the Anishinaabe are the first people, at least in the Northwest Territory of Michigan, but that's a name that's used for the Great Lakes region and for First Peoples. There is a story that at the origin of the Pleiades, that when the Pleiades originated, that the people of that time were given indication that they should celebrate the new year every year, five sleeps after the new moon when Pleiades are highest. Now, we use the Gregorian calendar, which is fixed, and it says that New Year's Day is happening on January 1st every year. It's not tied to what's happening in the night sky. But in the Anishinaabe culture, this was tied to phenomena that they had to be reading and watching in the sky. So the new moon for us happened on December 2nd. So five sleeps would take us to December 7th or 8th. And then what you would do is read those sleeps or read those dreams and also read the book of nature to find out what was coming in the new year. So if any of you are journalers, make sure you take a look at your journal and see what was going on around the 7th or the 8th to see if you can find your Anishinaabe new year. But so this image is from Sky and Telescope, so it shows the first crescent of the moon. This was 2 days after it was new on the 2nd. And now this is what we see. What's the date today? Is the 12th. So how many of you saw the moon on the way here? Yeah, so it's almost there. It's coming up to Pleiades. But Pleiades comes to its highest place every year in December. So when Pleiades are highest, the new moon closest to that time, that marks the counting point for when you would get the new year. So Happy New Year. And this is something that I looked into out of this understanding that Lem Johnson was giving us, that there are things happening and were happening in the culture here that weren't necessarily understood or respected by the people who moved the first peoples off of this land and then took it for their own. And one of the other things that's been happening in this year is the very exciting anticipation of comets. This was the path that Comet Ison was supposed to take. But Ison, if you've been listening to the news at all, didn't make it past its perihelion or meeting with the sun on Thanksgiving Day. There was all this excitement that maybe it had held together, but it's kind of fizzled out now. So what you see here is where it was coming toward its meeting with the sun in this region between the bright star Antares and the constellation Scorpio and the Omega star in the left foot of the constellation Ophiuchus, or the snake charmer. So Ison was supposed to then shoot up this way and still be visible. It was predicted a while ago that it might be a great comet, which meant not only that it would be very, very brilliant, but possibly visible during the daytime. That didn't happen. But Ison was interesting because of what it was able to teach astronomers about the mystery of comets. Comets are really unpredictable. They're wild. They come from, this was a long period comet, so coming from a very, very far distance and not one that has a predictable presence for us in the space of one human life. But the interesting thing about Ison, just like Pan-STARRS before it earlier this year, is that it wasn't named for the human beings that that discovered it. It was named for this International Science Optic Network, Ison. And this is a group of telescopes. It's an observing network that's in 10 different countries. So that rather than having just human beings out looking for comets now, we have these machines continually surveying and scanning the sky, and they're finding things really far away and things that are coming toward us. But it's a totally different experience than a human being finding something like that and then being able to tie it to what's happening historically, which is how comets were always regarded prior to our own time and the technology that we have available to us now. So earlier this year, there was Comet Pan-STARRS. Pan-STARRS stands for Panoramic Survey Telescope and Rapid Response System. So again, this particular system is owned and operated by the United States Air Force, always looking into the sky to see what foreign objects or unidentified objects might be coming toward us. So if you're a storyteller like me, trying to find the story in that is really hard, because I think the story you would have to tell would be about the people who created that kind of equipment, because they weren't necessarily there manning it when this machine is detecting that there's something, that then they're looking at a screen or looking at printouts to say, oh, there's something unexpected happening here. And now, because the machine has given us this indication, we can look into this region of the sky. So not to diminish that as a science and as research, but to say that it's a totally different experience than human beings going out and looking into the night sky, even with the use of a telescope. So what happened for me as a storyteller up north in northern Michigan was trying to find out where is Pan-STARRS becoming visible. And Pan-STARRS became visible in the watery region of the sky. So this is referred to as the watery region because here we find Eridanus, which is the river. We have Cetus the whale, Pisces the fishes, Aquarius the waterman, and Pistis austrinus, which is the southern fish. And Pan-STARRS became visible right around the mouth, the mouth star, Fomalhaut, in that constellation, and went up toward Aquarius. So I thought, okay, this is a great opportunity for us to talk about the water. We live in the Great Lakes region, so why not use this comet as an opportunity to tell stories about the water? And what happened was the Odawa, they have a grandmother moon drumming circle, and they had asked me, could we do a water ritual and a water ceremony? So we had a really lovely festival where we did this ceremony with the native people. I had a comet astronomer there talking about this, and then I did some storytelling, fairy tales connected to the water, one specifically from the Celtic wonder tales called the Salmon of Knowledge. And the hero is told that the Salmon of Knowledge swims in the heaven world, but we can find its reflection on the earth. So looking on the earth for something that reflects what's happening in the night sky. This was a common practice prior to our own time. So that there's in the midst of all the excitement and disappointment with Ison, there was another comet that was discovered, and this is the comet Lovejoy. Now, Lovejoy is different from Pan-STARRS and Ison because Lovejoy is actually a person. His name is Terry Lovejoy, and he's an Australian. He He's an amateur astronomer. He discovered a comet in 2011, and then this comet was just discovered in September of 2013. And it was quite close to ISON, at least looking from the Earth. You could see them both at the same time before ISON disintegrated. And now Lovejoy is getting pretty exciting because it came closest to the Earth in November, and it will make its perihelion, or closest pass with the sun, on Christmas Day. So there's a lot of potential for story in that. If you're a storyteller like me, it's like, let's look and see what's going on there. So Lovejoy was discovered in the region of the Beehive Cluster, also known as Messier Object Number 44, in the constellation of Cancer, the Crab. It was between Regulus and Jupiter at the time. So in the Beehive Cluster, this is a group of stars that looks just like a smudge. And I think it was Galileo, 400 or 500 years ago, who was the first one to say, that's actually a collection of stars. But if you look in ancient astrological texts, you see that all of the signs of the zodiac have dominion over a different part of the human body. Cancer was regarded as a crab because it has a hard outer shell. It ruled the rib cage that is protecting the soft inner organism. And that soft inner organism is the heart and lung system. But you see, you could imagine in this beehive cluster, which is just this cluster of stars, it looks kind of fuzzy. It's almost like the suggestion of the beginning of the formation of an organ. So this is what was understood by ancients when they looked into the sky. They saw this region of Cancer, the stars that made up the constellation, and then this inner region that we refer to as the Beehive Cluster. It was like just the beginnings of something. You could say it's the beginning of the formation of the heart, which was then governed by Leo, the next constellation in the zodiac. But so this is the region where Lovejoy was when it was discovered, and now it's going to move close to the sun on Christmas Day. So I think that that's really rich with story opportunity. I'm not going to tell you this story right now. I do a weekly program with Interlochen Public Radio, and that's where I tell a lot of those stories. But just the name is beautiful, the region where it was discovered is beautiful, and it's coming closest to the sun just after the sun has passed its kind of the darkest hour for us in the northern hemisphere, the still point at winter solstice. So it's a really wonderful imagination about something bright, something coming from the heart, something coming toward the sun at that darkest time. It's always, as I said, believed that comets were bearing a message. They were kind of freedom heroes of the universe. When they came in and they appeared, they heralded great things that were going to happen on the Earth. Now, up in northern Michigan, as I shared, right now what we're doing is publishing a magazine called The Essence of Emmet. And in this magazine, we're looking at the history of the kind of transformation from the tribal people toward first contact and then several different stages of history up there. And I wrote a piece about a phenomena that we refer to as a parhelion. How many of you have ever seen this? Where it looks like you see this strong flash of a rainbow on either side of the sun. Anybody ever seen that? Sometimes it's referred to as dog ears. I don't like to say that because I don't like to call it that, because that's not as beautiful as what this image is when it appears. But we see this quite often up north. It's more predominant in the winter months than it is in the summer. Usually starts to show up around September. So this phenomena, when it was witnessed in the 1600s, so up in the Straits area, we have the French missionaries and the Jesuits coming through that area, and they're starting to integrate their culture with the native people. Now, the French, when they came through the Straits area, they did something different than the English, who came 100 years after them. The French intermarried, and this was the way they befriended the people, because now they were dealing with families, and so they weren't necessarily going to war with each other. When the English came through, they didn't intermarry. They kept everybody apart, and so there was a great deal of animosity happening between them. But when this kind of an event was witnessed, it was so powerful that the French, the Jesuits, they made woodcuts of this phenomena and wrote home to France and said that there was an experience, and then it was in March of 1671, of three suns all day long. It didn't just look like this. They actually described it. There were three distinct suns. And it was a phenomenon they had never witnessed before, and they couldn't understand what was happening. And the Native American people approached them and said, "Why are you standing there staring at this? Those are the wives of the sun." And the Jesuit missionary said, "No, this is the Holy Trinity." And then he used that to inspire these folks to be baptized and to get their children baptized. But it's a remarkable moment of using a natural phenomena to impress one culture on another. And you begin to see a change happening in the Straits area and with the native people and adopting these new ideas, not necessarily because they're going to leave their own behind, but out of a willingness to try to move forward But then their own traditions get lost, their own understanding and their own capacity to read the signs in nature. One of the things that the Jesuit missionary wrote down about this phenomena was that the Native American people said to him that this meant that there would be a cold spell, and according to his record, then there was an unusual cold after this phenomena had been seen. So it was just this shifting in cultural consciousness and an awareness that the celestial phenomena indicated and that we continually use. As a storyteller, I'm often listening to what does the astronomical community say to us about the things that are being discovered. Because we as human beings just walking outside, looking up into the night sky, if it's clear, if it's dark, we can see on average between 7 and 10,000 objects. That's the estimate. But with the use of space telescopes, satellites, computers, we can identify over 900 million objects. To get from 10,000 to 900 million is a big jump. That's all stuff that you and I can't see if we just go outside. So somebody is telling us what that is. And I don't think there's any malicious intention on the person or people who are saying what that is, but they have very specific ideas about what's being looked for, just like the Jesuit missionary had a very specific idea about what he was going to see, and he used that to impress the culture of people that he was dealing with. So in my place, it's very important to listen to what are the astronomers saying about what's being discovered, not to diminish it or to deny it, but to listen to the language and to listen to what it gives rise to in me as a human being living within this celestial environment, because we're not outside of it looking at it. We're right within it. So this was an interesting phenomena. And just to give a little plug for this was a gal, Joan Sorensen from Harbor Springs, who actually took this picture within the last 12 months. And this is the magazine that will come out next year, which is called Essence of Emmet. So there is this first part will be about pre-contact through 1812. So pre-contact means what was going on in that region before the first Europeans came through in the middle of the 1600s. So I have recently in my research, out of this work, but then also because we are in 2013, we're 200 years away from the War of 1812, which lasted from 1812 to 1815. That was a very significant war, particularly for this region. And you hear about these things along the way, but you get Mishigamu, like Professor Johnson told us. And I couldn't put all of the pieces together. But what seems to be happening, and there may be historians here that know this better than I do, this is a picture, this is a fictional picture, but it's meant to depict Chief Tecumseh. He was a Shawnee chief that was born in the Ohio region. He was very instrumental and very effective in the War of 1812. And at the Fort of Detroit, it was because of him that they were able to take over that fort for at least a year during that war. He was never photographed. There was never a picture made of him. There was talk about him. He was a very tall man. He was a beautiful orator. He was very wise. He was always seen in Native garb. But if you Google him, you'll see him all dressed up in a British uniform. Because of the War of 1812, the British worked with the Native American people in this area to battle against the Americans. But what's happening is he was born in 1768. 1768 happened to be the last year of the Venus transit cycle that happened from 1762 to 1769. Now, a Venus transit cycle is an 8-year period of time where the planet Venus, at the beginning of the cycle, seems to move directly in front of the sun, and then it will make 5 retrograde loops over the next 8-year period and then move over the sun one more time, and then that won't happen again for another 100 to 120 years. We've just had a Venus transit time from 2004 to 2012. So Tecumseh is born in 1768, which is the last year of that Venus transit cycle. That particular cycle was studied by a lot of astronomers in Europe. They positioned themselves in different places around the globe, sometimes traveling up to 2 years to get to their location, to measure the timing of that transit so that they could then use that information shared with their colleagues from different countries and different places to figure out the distance between the Earth and the sun. So this phenomenon was really remarkable and well-studied and well-watched. But Tecumseh is being born at this time. Now, 1768, this is before the American Revolution. So the colonists are here, and then in 1776, they revolt against Britain. Now, what happens is the French and the Indians get together. They have a war under Chief Pontiac, who's also significant in this area, and they're trying to battle the British and get them off their lands. Then we get to 1812, and now what's happening is the British are joining with the Native Americans, and they're trying to get the Americans off of their land. So if you read the history, it looks like the Indians are always just showing up to help the British or to help the Americans. But I'm sure that from Tecumseh's perspective, these folks were helping him to protect his land. And he had a confrontation with William Henry Harrison, and it was that Harrison bought land from other tribes that Tecumseh worked with. And Tecumseh said to him, you can't buy the land. We don't own the land, so you can't buy it from someone. We all share it, and we use it together. Well, Harrison didn't have the same idea about land use and land ownership, and he wiped out Tecumseh's village, which was a prophet's town, and I'm not sure, but I think it was named for his brother, who was a self-proclaimed prophet. But Tecumseh made use of the natural phenomena of his time to rally his people together so that they could try to protect their tribal lands. There was a great comet in 1811, there was an eclipse of the sun, and there was a major earthquake that really rallied all of the native people behind Tecumseh, and they did a great deal to try to protect their lands, and one of the things they did was overtake Fort Detroit, which was supported by the fact that the Native American people up in the Straits region, where the headlands is, they had captured the fort on Mackinac Island. And once that success and that victory had happened, a lot of the warriors from the Odawa Nation up there traveled down to southeast Michigan to support Tecumseh to then overtake Fort Detroit. And they did some very clever things to do that. But the name Tecumseh means shooting star across the sky. So in Native American tradition, when a child is born, the name that is spoken is usually only spoken by the mother, and she keeps that name. The name that everyone else knows the child by is a different name. But there was also a tradition that when the Native American would then marry or mate, that the mother would question the intended mate. Could they speak the name of who this being would be? And it's a remarkable way of figuring out, maybe this is a filter or a test that the mother can see, have you really come to the heart of who this person is? Because only I know the true name. So Tecumseh, to be named shooting star across the sky, then you would think, all right, well, maybe there was a significant shooting star at the time that he was born. As best they can tell, Tecumseh was born in March of 1768. If you look it up, you can see that in 1768 there was a major fireball, but it was not over this region. And it was the way it's described, it's like the fireball that just went over Russia, where things really shook and there was a loud explosion. And this, you know, several hundred years ago would have been regarded as a sign or as a message. And then we have this individual, Tecumseh, showing up, and he's doing something really remarkable in this area, trying to protect his tribal lands. But what happens during the War of 1812 to 15, he goes with the British over to Ontario, and at the Battle of the Thames, he's slain in 1813. So 200 years ago in October, so just 200th anniversary was just 2 months ago. And there's a few different stories about what happened to him when he died. Some of the Americans tried to claim that they had the body, but the native people really believed that he was fatally wounded, but he was able to leave the battlefield, and they took his body and they hid it away, and to this day no one knows where his remains were buried. So his birth was indicated by a shooting star, and the earth is his grave. So this in initiation science, or when you look at the history of people who practice mysteries and these sacred ceremonies, this is the mark of a very high initiate, somebody who really has a mission with regard to his people. But because of Tecumseh, what was happening, because he was trying to protect the land, once he got slain, the tribes dispersed, the British retreated, and the Americans were able to push the tribal people off their land and continue their expansion west to create the United States of America. So up in northern Michigan, because we have a very strong presence of the tribe, this is big stuff, big, important stuff. And I don't want to say that they're waiting up there, but there's a lot that goes on around the celebrations that I'm a European descendant. I'm mostly Irish, and then the rest is British Isles. So again, very shy about telling the Native American stories, but the celebration of Thanksgiving or the celebrations of the New Year, certain things that belong culturally more to Western Europe than they do to the United States of America. They're very vocal about it up there. How many of you are of Native American tradition or heritage here? Well, this has been a really exciting experience for me to witness all of this. And I heard it first from Len Johnson. Really, when you grow up in this, you hear all of these names, Tecumseh or Michigan, Huron, Saginaw, all of these things coming out of the Native American language, but not necessarily connecting. You also hear Ford, Walter Reuther, all of these things that belong to the history of this place and this area. But at least with regard to the Native Americans, they were connecting them to the natural phenomena. Tecumseh himself, his name means shooting star across the sky. How many of you knew that? How many of you have been to Tecumseh? It's not that far away. Also, I had a conversation with this gentleman from the tribe up north that he said there's several different ways to pronounce that name. Tecumseh, Tecumseh, you put the accent or the emphasis in a different place. And I think this belongs to the idea that it was an oral language. I mean, that sounds kind of redundant. We speak, we use our language to speak, but we also write it down. These are languages that weren't necessarily written down, because the way you spoke it, then that was how you were indicating the part of the character of the individual that you were speaking about. If you were speaking about Tecumseh as a chief, you would say it one way. If you were speaking about Tecumseh as a warrior, it would be another thing. If you were speaking about him as a father or a speaker, it would come out a different way. So it's very difficult to write that down. In northern Michigan, we have the Odawa. I always heard it as Ottawa. It's spelled different, it's pronounced different, and actually they fight amongst themselves about what's the correct pronunciation, what's the correct spelling. So it's a very interesting transition from an oral tradition to something that's written and that's fixed, and now it's the name of a casino. I mean, there's all these cultural things going on that are really remarkable, and I don't know that any of them celebrate the new year according to five sleeps after the new moon when the Pleiades are highest. This is information that's being lost because their culture got swallowed up by what was coming toward them from the first European settlers that came through the area. So we're still in the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812 that lasted until 1815. So actually everything from 1976 to 2015 is a really remarkable period of time where 200 years ago we had the formation of what we now know as the United States of America, the first colonists, first battling against the British and then turning around and battling against the people native to this land to carve out their own space and pushing back on both sides. The Native Americans, first they banded with the French to defend against the British, then they banded with the British to defend against the Americans, and then they lost their lands. Kind of remarkable stuff, so there's my little history lesson right now. But Tecumseh, it means shooting star across the sky. So the Fairy Tale Moons exhibit that you see on the wall here is original watercolor art that was painted by my sister, artist Patricia DeLisa. And the project was inspired by an idea I had that we could use the Native American tradition and the indigenous tradition of peoples around the world to name the full moon every month. And the idea was that if we could name the full moon according to traditional tales, then that would give the user access to stories connected with the night sky. So if you came through the lobby, or I'll call it a lobby, the little area out there, you'll see there's a really lovely exhibit about food in children's literature. And when we were putting this exhibit up, I thought, oh, we could have called it the stars in children's literature, but it doesn't work that way. You don't find the star names in children's literature, because fairy tales and folk tales are coming out of the wisdom of how you teach the youth and teach one another about the moral imaginations and the moral wisdom that informs a community and builds the traditions. And you wouldn't speak the name of the hero or of the dragon or of the demon, because that would give them power or it would diminish them. Just the same way the Native Americans wouldn't share the name that only the mother knew of the child that was born, because it would be taking the power away from them. So what I did in my research, I didn't know I was researching, but going along the way, reading all these tales, learning about the night sky, learning the star lore, was to bump into the fact that over and over again in different cultures you find the same tales, and they seem to indicate some of the stories that we find in the night sky in different cultural traditions. So I did take liberties. It wasn't arbitrary. It was to find stories that had very specific pieces that you could connect with the night sky in a given month throughout the seasons of the year. And out of that came the Fairy Tale Moons calendar. So we have 36 original watercolor paintings. And what I would do is get the story, then I would call my sister and say, okay, here's the tale, here's the part I want you to paint, and then I would describe it connected with the celestial phenomena that it belonged to. So there are two out of those 3 years that we did this calendar. There were two specifically that were related to Native American tales. The first one is the a story that was beautifully illustrated by George, I'm going to say McDermott, but I might not be getting his name correctly. McDonald, thank you. This is the story called Arrow to the Sun. Now, the young man who's here at the bottom, it's his story, really, because he's a fatherless child. And he was regarded, the fatherless children, the orphans, or those who don't have both parents, they were regarded as special members of the community. They weren't looked down upon. They were celebrated and taken into homes because they carried something special. So he decides, he asks his mother about his father, and she says, you'll have to go find him yourself, basically. So he sets out, and he gives himself no small task. He decides that his father is the sun. So he goes to the sun, and he says, Father, it is I, your son. And the sun says to him, perhaps you are my son, and perhaps you are not. And in order to find out, you must be, basically, he's telling him, he has to go through an initiation process where he must go through the kiva of the bees, the kiva of the lion, the kiva of the serpents, and the kiva of thunder. So in my reading of that story, he's really speaking quite specifically, without mentioning it, without saying it, without invoking it, the high constellations of the summer. The kiva of bees could suggest the beehive cluster at the heart of the constellation Cancer the Crab. The kiva of lions could suggest the constellation Leo. The kiva of serpents could suggest the hydra, which rises up at spring equinox and snakes around everything while the sun is coming to its highest hour at solstice, and then we see the tail of it going over the horizon at fall equinox. And then the thunder, related to the season of the thunder, which comes after the solstice in the summertime in the month of July. So I'm just telling, like, this is how I put it together. So this story, which is up here, you can see the original of it behind the screen. This is the story of the arrow to the sun. And then the other story that we used, this story comes from a Pueblo tradition, so further west. And then this story is how the stars fell into the sky. And this one comes from a Navajo tradition. And it's a really, really lovely story of explaining how we have this pattern and why a lot of us can't understand it or can't see it. And the story is that at the close of the first day, first man and first woman gathered to survey all that had been created. And first woman stood with the blanket of stars at her feet, and she looked at first man and said, we need to write the laws so that the people of the earth will always be able to live in harmony with what has been created in the world. Where should we write the laws? And first man was very tired after the work of creating the world, and he looked at first woman and he said, why not write them on the water? That's a good place. And first woman said, oh, first man, that will never do, because brother wave will wash the laws away and the people will not be able to read them and know how to live in harmony. First man said, then why not write them on the sands? And first woman said, no, that won't do either, because brother wind will blow the laws away from the sand and the people will not be able to read them and understand how to live in harmony. Well, first man was ready to close this first day. And he looked back at first woman standing there with this blanket of stars at her feet, and he said, why not write the laws in the sky? And first woman said, this is the right idea. So very carefully she took first one star and then another and placed them into the sky, careful to create a pattern that she knew all people would be able to understand and recognize so that they could live in harmony with everything that had been created and with one another. It was long work. And you could say it was lonely work, but first woman was not alone in this work. There was someone watching her, and that someone was Coyote. He was behind a tree, and pretty soon his curiosity overtook him, and he trotted out from behind the tree, and he said, first woman, what are you doing? And first woman said, I'm writing the laws so that all people may know how to live in harmony. And Coyote said, may I help? And first woman said, indeed, you may. And she handed him first one star, and then another star, and then another. Well, for every star that Coyote placed into the sky, he looked back at first woman's blanket and saw 100 million more stars. And he said, first woman, this is going to take a long time. And first woman said, indeed, Coyote, so it shall, but I can think of no more important work to do for the rest of my days. Because think of the warriors when they travel away from their communities and their homes. They can look up into the sky and see the same stars that their families are seeing before they go to bed at night, and they will still know their togetherness and their harmony. and the people will always be able to read the stars and know how to live with one another and how to live in Mother Nature's realm. This will take a long time, and this is important work. Well, Coyote thought to himself that he didn't have the patience for that. So while First Woman wasn't looking, he grabbed the corners of her blanket and he flung all the stars into the sky. "Oh, Coyote," said First Woman, hanging her head deep into the night, "how could you have done such a thing?" For now the stars were scattered across the sky. She said, "Now the people of the earth will not be able to read the patterns. They will not know how to live in harmony with one another." Coyote put his tail between his legs and trotted away. And so it was believed by the Navajo people that this is the reason for the chaos that prevails on the earth. And then I like to give a little addendum. Some of the patterns were placed, and some of them are visible, and there are yet those who can read those patterns. And these are our storytellers, reading the pattern of the night sky as it was established by First Woman and First Man way back after the close of the first day. Now I'm going to show you, this is kind of what it looks like at Headlands right now. Actually, we have more snow than that. I was really surprised when I got down here because I'm still in Michigan. You don't have any snow down here. It's really wild and wintry up north right now. Really good skiing, but really cold, really blowing, and a lot of snow. Dangerous driving. But this is the shoreline of the Headlands. Looking west, this is actually land that you see right here. That's Waugashant's Point, which is part of Wilderness State Park. After we got the Headlands designation as the 6th International Dark Sky Park in 2011, 6th International Dark Sky Park in the United States. There have been several more since that time. In 2012, then, the state of Michigan protected an additional 23,000 acres, and then just this past year, we were contacted by the National Park Service Dark Sky Management Team because they want to partner with us in protecting the skies in the Great Lakes region. So we went from the county level to the state level to the national level in our ability to work with communities to try to raise awareness around dark skies, and it's really been marvelous. So this is one of the telescopes that we have that we use right now. We were given the gift of the dome off the observatory at Cranbrook Institute of Science. They renovated their observatory, so they gave us their dome. It's sitting in a hangar at Pellston Airport way up north, waiting for a building and a telescope. So that's in the plan for that to come. But right now, when you go to Headlands, you'll find a dark wilderness. We don't have a 360-degree view of the horizon. We have a lot of woods, a lot of untouched woods. This piece of property is very, very important to the Native Americans in that region because this is where they settled. The estimate is that between the region of the Mackinac Bridge down to Harbor Springs, upwards of 40,000 Native people lived, fished, and recreated there over the years. And then they would come south in the winter months when it gets really, really cold like this. So the next programs that we have coming up at the Headlands, this Saturday we have what I call a Festival of Light. This is really inspired by a tradition that I know about through the Waldorf schools, the Advent Garden, where you build a spiral of light and the children are told the story and they walk through to a center candle and light their light, and then they place it along that spiral on the way out. Out of this idea of the celebration that each of us comes from this source of light, but we shine our light into the world in a different way. And this is a tradition that belongs not only to the Waldorf schools, but to many different cultures around the world, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, celebrating the birth of light at the darkest time of year, which is the winter solstice moment. So this Saturday, we'll be doing a program out in the snow. We're building our spiral in the snow and telling the story, ideally under the stars, but if it's not cloudy, then it's going to be really, really cold, because when we don't have cloud cover, it gets cold up there. So that's our next event that, if you're coming up north, I recommend it, but make sure that you check the weather to see how the driving is. That will be happening this Saturday. And then the following Friday, I have a program called Women in the Stars, and I recently was subjected to an interview about this event, and the interviewer asked me, did I often do theme-type programs? And I kind of laughed when he asked me that, because every program I do has a theme. And I said, you know, in 2012, there was a lot of hoopla about the end of the Mayan calendar, and a lot of people got up in arms about what was going to happen when that took place. And even Lady Gaga, I was told Lady Gaga planned her concerts according to the celestial phenomena that were happening in 2012. And I thought, well, I've been doing that for a long time before Lady Gaga came along. So the reason I call this particular event Women in the Stars is because it's on the eve of winter solstice. And winter solstice, in some stories, is particularly a story that comes out of Northern Europe, solstice is a goddess that is escorted to the earth by the two great bears. Now, at solstice time, we have one of our meteor showers called the Ursids. It gets its name from where the radiant appears. The center point that the stars seem to shoot from is between the constellations Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, the great bears. So you could imagine that solstice is like this goddess who these shooting stars are indicating her passage toward the earth. But also, it's a time for, because it's the darkest time of year, it was regarded in the Greek, ancient Greek tradition as the entrance into the womb of the mother. And then on that day, on the 21st of December, so this event is the night before, it's the 20th, but the next day the planet Venus will start a retrograde motion, which means it appears to move backward from the direction that we usually see it moving in. Now, how many of you saw Venus before you got here tonight? Venus is brilliant right now. But on December 21st, Venus is going to stop in her tracks and it's going to move in the opposite direction. This is the first retrograde motion of the planet Venus since it made its transit in 2012. So I looked at that and thought, that would create a nice story opportunity to talk about Venus. Venus is always regarded as the goddess of love and beauty, sometimes as a goddess of war. In the Central American tradition of the indigenous people, when Venus was evening star, morning star, Venus is goddess of war. And Venus is changing position from evening star to morning star when it makes this retrograde motion. So I thought, let's talk about women in the stars, not only the mythology, not only the planetary ideas, but then also women in the history of studying the night sky. Women astronomers, women astronauts. Let's just give that emphasis. So that's where that idea came from. It wasn't some astrological interpretation of things going on. It was just, let's just look at the phenomena, tease out the elements from the cultural history of humanity, and figure out, is there any connection? And then with the opportunity to see Venus, it will be really brilliant that night near the, actually it's the next event where we'll still see Venus in the evening sky near the crescent moon. This event I also called Beyond the Telescope. We have a Native American guest storyteller, Joe Mitchell, and he will be telling tales from the Odawa tradition up there on the lands where they tell their stories, and I'm really excited about this event. This will happen on Saturday, January 4th, and when I first contacted him, it was the middle of summer, and I wanted him to come in the fall, and I said, Joe, will you come and tell stories in October? And he said, no. And I said, why not? And he said, because that's not the time for storytelling. I said, what do you mean? He said, there's no snow on the ground in October. I said, why does there have to be snow on the ground? He said, because that's the time for storytelling. I didn't know that. So I said, okay, then I'm going to call you back when it snows. So there's a lot of snow on the ground now. This picture is a testament to it. So it's time for telling stories. So really looking forward to that event, which happens in January. And then we do events year-round. On the back table there, we have the Headlands program brochure. This is kind of the backbone of our programming schedule, but you can go to the Emmett County website to get more information about programs that we add throughout the year. One of the really exciting celestial phenomena that's coming up for us in this next year is in April of 2014, the full moon, the vernal full moon, first full moon after vernal equinox, will be totally eclipsed. This will be the first total eclipse of the moon that we'll be seeing since 2011. So that's kind of exciting, but those things happen after midnight. So if you want to come, make your plans now so that you've got a good place to rest before you get out to Headlands to watch that event. And then I also, in addition to doing programs at Headlands, I do cruises with Schepler's Ferry Service along the Straits of Mackinac. We go out. Usually I time them to when the full moon is coming up over Lake Huron and the sun is setting in Lake Michigan, and we motor out underneath the Mackinac Bridge and then back. And it's a really, really lovely experience. This year, we will do two cruises around the time of the Perseid meteor shower. Even though there's a full moon on August 10th, which will diminish the Perseids, it's still a lovely environment to be in, to be out under full moonlight on the straits with the potential for shooting stars. I can think of few things more beautiful. And it's a really lovely experience to dream into the Native American people. And I will confess that I have canoed across the Straits of Mackinac. I didn't realize how foolish it was until after I did it. it's not an easy body of water to navigate, even if you're in a motorized vehicle. I didn't know that. The currents are really wild. They can change very quickly. The weather can kick up very fast. It was November 2nd, 2005. It was a perfectly calm, beautiful day. It took about 3 hours to canoe from Mackinac City to St. Ignace and back. And I found out later I'm kind of a legend because not many people have done that. Have any of you ever paddled through the Straits of Mackinac? Okay, well, it's doable. All right, so I'm going to end with, I can't see what time it is. No, about 10 to 8. This was a picture that was taken at the Headlands by photographer Chris Riley. There's his telescope right there. This is Pleiades, and this is the region of the constellation Taurus the Bull. The Pleiades, I started with Pleiades by saying Happy New Year. When Pleiades comes highest in the month of December, then that's when the Anishinaabe said, okay, five sleeps after new moon. When Pleiades is highest, that's the season for celebrating the new year. So I wanted to close with this picture of Pleiades, the seven sisters, which are the most storied about group of stars in the sky around the world, oftentimes in most traditions regarded as the point of origin for everything in our universe. The seven sisters in the book of Proverbs, it is, wisdom hath builded her house, she hath hewn out her seven pillars, the seven colors of the rainbow, the seven classical planets that lend their names to the 7 days of the week. Anywhere that we find seven, it's usually rooted in some type of mythology, legend, or origin, creative myth about the Pleiades. So this is what's visible at Headlands. It's really interesting when you look at photographs of the night sky because a camera lens can see different things than a human eye can see. So you see these beautiful pictures of the Aurora Borealis or of the Milky Way, and people say, does it really look like that? And it's true that it looks like that, but the human eye experiences it a different way. So you're all invited to come to Headlands. If you come during the daytime, you can take in what I call the Dark Sky Discovery Trail, which is a series of planetary stations that are not set according to relative distances of the planets from the sun in our system, but every tenth of a mile, because it made it easier to do it if we wanted to include Pluto, because if we included Pluto, then Pluto would be at the entrance and everything else would be at the dark sky viewing area all crunched together because we didn't have enough room. Pluto was demoted from full-on planet status in 2006, but we wanted to include it because the Dark Sky Discovery Trail is a humanities approach to understanding the planets and planetary discovery. And the planet Pluto, when it was discovered by Clyde Tombaugh in February of 1930, there was a search that went out around the world for the name of this planet. And it was an 11-year-old girl from England who named the planet Pluto. She wasn't thinking about Disney because that had not been created yet. She was thinking about her classical and Roman mythology. And she said to her grandfather, when he read to her the description of this new planet that had been discovered by this young man in America, that it was cold and it was very dark and it was very far away. And she said, that sounds like the god of the underworld. Why don't they name it Pluto? And so her grandfather telegraphed his friends at Oxford and they telegraphed the observatory out in Arizona, and a month later it was announced that that was the name. And there was a young man at that time who had just introduced a cartoon mouse named Mickey, and he decided in order to celebrate this planet's discovery and its new name that he would create a companion for that mouse, a dog, and he named him Pluto. So now you know. All right, so I think we were going to allow for questions. Hopefully you have questions, lots of good questions.
I have a microphone here, so...
All right.
I wonder if you've heard the term sun dogs, and what is that? I've read it, but I didn't know what it was.
Did you come in after I showed the slide?
No.
I
know you said the one was called dog ears, and it, you know, had that.
And that's also sun dogs.
Is that the same thing?
Referring to the
sun
same
dogs.
Thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is the same thing.
So the description of it, if you look for the scientific description, is it's light shining through hexagonal crystals in certain kinds of clouds. It's a beautiful description. I'll just leave it at that. It's hard for me to imagine things aren't random, but that seems so fixed. When that phenomena occurs, it's not always the same conditions happening. So it's a really lovely thing to kind of dream into.
For those of us who are avid amateur astronomers,
yes,
down south here, what do you actually do in terms of getting telescopes set up? to show
at people the Headlands?
Yeah, to do public observation.
So, as I said, it's a dark wilderness. It's not developed at all. We did receive a gift of money to build telescope pads, and we haven't done that yet because there's a building there that's being taken down, and we couldn't put anything in before that was taken down because there's some facilities that need to be provided. We don't have, once that building came down, that means now we don't have restrooms up there. So we have to build that, and all of these things need to be built together. So right now, there isn't facility for setting up really elaborate telescope equipment. If you can carry it, then good. Or you can come to the parking lot area and just open your trunk and unload right there.
Yeah, see, that's one of the problems that we have with the astronomy club is usually, well, we actually lost. We had there was a farm up north near Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Atlanta is the elk capital of Michigan, and we got them to realize they are really, you know, the potentially a dark sky capital of Michigan also, because there's absolutely nothing up in Atlanta. And for a couple of years, we had the use of a farm out there. Some folks owned a farm, and we would come and set up and end up with a lot of people coming for the star party.
Yes,
because they would, the folks that owned the farm were realtors, and they would just spread the news.
Yeah.
And we would have dozens and dozens of people show up, many more than actually we usually have show up at Peach Mountain here in Ann Arbor. And when we've heard about these other dark sky sites, like the Headlands, the problem for us is when we're, you know, carting in big telescopes.
Big equipment, right.
Yeah, I have a 24-inch scope. Yeah. You know, you set it down, and at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you don't want to have to take it down and pack it away and then
so
go
I
find
will,
a place.
So I will have to share with you that as I tried to emphasize, I come at this from the cultural humanities and as a storyteller, as a person with a degree in English literature, so I wasn't thinking telescopes at all. And not because I don't want telescopes to be there, it just wasn't part of what I was doing. And when I approached the Emmett County commissioners and said, you've got a naturally dark wilderness here, we could protect this and really develop an awareness in our community about why dark skies are such a wonderful asset. And they unanimously supported that. And then we approached the International Dark Sky Association, went through their criteria, it ended up being a 2-year, 75-page process. But again, it didn't require of us saying, here's where the telescopes will go. It was just, is there light on the property? How do you intend to manage the light? And going forward, what will you do if there's any kind of development? So the question about telescopes didn't come up until pretty late. And it's like, oh, people with telescopes need to be accommodated. And it wasn't, so that wasn't what motivated it, although it wasn't, it was overlooked, but not intentionally, just because I was the one leading the initiative, and I don't use a telescope.
Is there, because there are buildings on the property, as I said, I biked through there years ago before they developed it.
Yeah.
Is there any hope for the possibility of people to maybe do astronomy like that and stay overnight and not have to take our telescopes down in the middle of the night?
There is. That's part of the concept plan now. As I said, we got the dome from Cranbrook. So there's a program building with an observatory, and there's space. There's an outdoor seating. There's the telescope pads, and all of this is. And we need to hear from you. Okay, here's what we want, because it is a public property. You know, it's publicly owned, and I'm not the best informed about what an astronomer with big equipment needs.
Well, you've probably heard this before. Just that even to set up tents.
Yes.
That we can crawl into after we're done observing at 2 or 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, because that really makes it.
It does make it,
That's all we need. That's all we need. And we've had this problem. Atlanta has also set up, Atlanta, Michigan, has also set up an area, a public park, that they want for observing, but there's nowhere to stay. You know, we can't stay overnight.
So at the Headlands, there's a guest house that is available for rent. It sleeps up to 22. And there's, Mackinac City has lots of hotel rooms. In fact, they're very excited about the Dark Sky Park because of how many people are coming. And it's remarkable the number of people that come that don't know anything about astronomy, don't have access to telescopes, but they just want to be in the dark. So we've really been able to celebrate that part of it because, as I said, it's not just a wide open space. You're not on a wide open field. And one of the things that's important about knowing about an International Dark Sky Park, it's not necessarily the only dark place. It's just a dedicated, protected dark sky place so that we can teach about it, and then ideally people can go from there into their own communities and then do something about protecting the night sky. So I'll talk to you about that. Thank you.
On the internet, is there a site for the Headlands Dark Sky Park where we could see the programs?
Yes. So if you pick up this brochure in the back, on the back of it, it gives you the website information. It's the Emmett County website. It's just emmettcounty.org/darksky park/. But you don't have to go through all that. If you get to the homepage of Emmett County, there's a big mark right there. You just press that. It takes you right to the Headlands page. And then I have an email address, which is darksky@emmettcounty.org. And twice a month, if I'm not too busy, I try to do a video email blast where we talk about programs we're doing at the Headlands and then what can be seen overhead. And I can't help myself. It's always got poetry and mythology and a bunch of stuff added to it because I like the story part of it.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you can sign up for that. We don't sell that list. We don't solicit you for anything. And as I said, it's on average twice a month. Yeah.
Mary, if you'd just reiterate that brief little story about the two Japanese ladies that were setting up.
Oh, we were talking earlier. I was sharing with Amy, and I'm sorry I didn't get your name. Yeah, some of the gentlemen that came earlier, that we have had remarkable turnout at our programs and at the property. We have people coming from right locally, and I always tell the local folks, you are the litmus test, because if you're coming, then it means it matters as well. People from around the state, around the region, around the nation, and around the world. We regularly have international folks at our programs. But one of the most touching experiences that I had was two young women from Japan who I don't know if they were students here. They kind of just said, well, we came through Ann Arbor. And they were coming at night, and I had just done a cruise, and I thought, well, let's just drive over to Headlands and see what's going on, because it was a beautiful night, and I knew there would be a lot of people there. Even without programming, with nothing going on, we can have 200 people there, just spread out along the shore because they want to be in the dark. So these gals were unloading this big equipment from the back of their SUV, and they were kind of being quiet about it, and I just was so excited, like, where did you come from, and what are you doing? And I think they were shy because they thought maybe they were going to get in trouble. And I said, no, I'm really interested to know how you found out about this and how you got here. And they said that they were from Japan and that they don't see the sky in Japan. Period. They don't see the sky. Not we don't see the Milky Way, we don't get to see the sky. We don't see the sky there. They were so thrilled they had brought enough stuff with them. You can't technically camp overnight at Headlands because there aren't facilities, but you can stay out overnight all night. And they planned to stay out for two or three nights just to be under the stars. It made me cry. I mean, it was really so beautiful. There was another night I walked down the path, and I overheard, and I don't want to disturb people when they're in the dark and they're just laying on the ground and they're looking up, and it was a man telling his son a story about the stars, and I kind of edged closer, and I couldn't help myself. I finally said, where are you from? And they were from Maryland. They have friends that live in Michigan who told them about the Headlands, and they packed up their family and came up for their summer trip just to get underneath the sky. It's a really, really important experience for people. And looking through a telescope is an amazing phenomenon, too. But my approach has always been to say, okay, here's the poetry of it. Here's the art of it. Here's the mythology of it. And then we go outside, and there it is. And now let's look through a telescope at it. So we're building this experience right out of the cultural history of humanity that starts with just this naked eye observation and then goes further and further and further, but always with the awareness that the more technology we use, the further away we can get from the Earth, but we have to be mindful that on the Earth we're losing the dark and we're losing access to that natural environment. So let's not get too far away too quickly. Remember, this also needs to be honored and protected. And when that message comes through story, it's not so burdensome. So that's why I like to start with a once upon a time, so you see it all the way around the wall. To raise awareness that this is something that belongs to the cultural history of humanity, we are at risk of losing it. Because we do teach astronomy, we don't necessarily teach star lore, we don't necessarily teach star names, we don't always teach constellations. I have met many astronomers that know things about Messier objects, globular clusters, they know certain stars, but they don't know what constellations they belong to. But these stories inform the cultural history of humanity. And if you're living where you can't see it, and you're not being taught its name, then you're losing a relationship of something that has belonged to us for longer than our electric light and our telescopes. So it's really, really important, I think, to emphasize that part of it, not to diminish the science and not to diminish the research of things that are beyond our vision with the naked eye, but to keep that in companionship with it so that it keeps that really, you know, kind of the flesh and bones on it, of the human encounter and the human experience. So as long as I'm program director at the Headlands, you'll always find the accent mark right there. And I hope you appreciate it.
You mentioned the Pleiades and the seven. Is there any lore around the seven notes of the musical scale?
And you're a musician, aren't you?
Yes.
And you're a twin, aren't you?
I am.
You look familiar to me.
And the name of the group is Gemini. Yes, make it even more complicated. Yeah.
I'm sure that there are, but I don't know one that's related to that. But I'm sure that there are. In the Anishinaabe story, it's how they it's that the youth are not invited to the ceremony of the elders. And the son of the chief is really upset because he thinks that he's old enough and mature enough that he can go to this ceremony. And so he spies on the elders, and he sees them bringing their food and bringing their offerings and building their fire and then dancing and singing around the fire. So he makes up his mind that he's going to have a ceremony just like that. And so he says to his companions, let's us have our own ceremony, and we won't invite the elders. And so they wait for the right night. And each one of them is given an assignment. One is to bring song, one is to bring food, another is to bring fire, and they will gather together and they'll have their own ceremony. And so when the appointed night arrives, they go to their gathering place, but the one who was to bring the song didn't bring it, and the one who was to bring the food didn't bring it. And only the chief's son, who was responsible for bringing the fire, he brought the fire, so they built the fire. And they decided, well, we know enough. We can do a dance around the fire. And they began to dance. And as they danced, their feet began to lift off the earth. And the more they danced, the higher and the higher and higher they got. But just as their feet began to lift off the earth, the mother of the chief's son noticed that he was not in his bed sleeping where he should have been. And she awakened the chief, and they went to the other families and found that, in fact, all of the youth were gone. And they heard this noise, they heard this sound, and they followed the sound. And when they got there, they saw the children already spiraling up and up and up into the sky. And only one of the children looked back, and it was the chief's son. He looked back on the face of his mother, and he fell to the earth, but then was never seen again. And all the children disappeared into the sky, and the people stood in wonder and in grief. But then the voice of the Great Spirit was heard and said unto them, you are not to be sad about this. This will give you the indication for the beginning of the celebration of the new year. And when you see these stars, the Pleiades, when you see these stars come to their highest place, then count you five sleeps from the new moon and celebrate the new year. So this is the tale that comes from specifically from the Great Lakes region. Not from a tribe out west or some other part of the world, but right from this area where we are. This is the story of finding the new year relative to the stars. And you can see them if it's clear. It's been pretty overcast up north. But so that's as close as I can get. They were supposed to bring a song and didn't. Yeah, but I'm sure it's there. And if you find it, I'd be happy if you shared it with me.
So how did your background in literature evolve into this association with astronomy?
Well, I was asked that question by a high schooler once because he was doing this career interview, and he said, how do I get into that? And he said, how did you get from English literature to this? And so, well, it's quite simple, really, because language is about rhythm, and so is the night sky. The moon waxes and wanes. The sun rises and sets. The planets move. We see the stars in their season, particularly the circumpolar constellations going around and around. This is all rhythm. And we are immersed in that, and we find it also in our language. That's the short answer. The long answer is that while I was a student here, it was actually through astrology. I found an astrology book, and it was like a living jigsaw puzzle. Like, oh, I put this piece here, it means one thing. If I move it over there, it means something else, according to this ancient tradition. Not, oh, I'm going to go predict my life, but I can see this pattern. And is there anything to that? And then at the same time, I started to have a family, and I read my children fairy tales every night. And 12 years down the road of that, I had enough star knowledge and enough fairy tale knowledge that it just kept bumping into each other But a few years prior to that, my daughter Jane said to me, "Mom, what are you doing?" One night I was looking at an ephemeris that just gives a list of the degrees that the planets occupy every day of the year. I said, "Well, I'm reading," I tried to answer her in six-year-old speak. I said, I'm reading the story of someone's life in the stars." And she said, "Well, you're cheating." I said, "What do you mean I'm cheating?" She said, "You need to be out reading the stars." So I closed my ephemeris and I thought, well, she's right. I need to go out and learn about the night sky. I couldn't identify Aries. I didn't know what Gemini looked like. I knew the names of those things, and I knew the astrological mythology connected to them, but I didn't know what they looked like. So then I began to just, I got the Abrams Planetarium Sky Calendar from Michigan State University, and I didn't have a red flashlight, didn't have a telescope, anything. I would run in the house, and I would look at it, and I would run back outside, and I would look up, and, I mean, really unsophisticated, just looked over and over and over again, and then continued on with the other things that were happening in my life, and then it all came together. I grew up in Southeast Michigan. I went to school here. I didn't move to Northern Michigan until 2002. And when I got there, I had just all this information, and I thought, gosh, it's dark up here. There's great places to teach about this. So I went and knocked on every door I could find. It could have been a camp. It was the community college, the newspaper, the radio station, anywhere that I could find an audience. I would say, "Hey, we ought to be talking about the night sky." And so along the way, people would say, "Okay, sounds like you know something about what you're talking about." So I started to build audience up there. And then I was introduced to Mary Lou Tanton, who started the Outdoor Lighting Forum, which is an organization in Petoskey that celebrates and awards businesses and residents in a 3-county area that practice conscientious outdoor lighting. So her whole point was just, let's award them so that they'll get in the paper, it's good press, and it'll raise awareness. And so she became aware of the work I was doing, and she said, "We want to give you an award." And it worked, because then I got involved in her organization, and that was in about 2005, 2006. And then together with another community member, we started to meet around, okay, we've got the technical aspect of the lighting, you've got all this cultural humanity stuff with the story, we've got this piece of property, let's put this all together and create something. So out of that, then, I really made it my business to try to listen to what's being said in astronomy. And I listen as an English literature person. What words are being used? Because, sorry, it's getting long. But when I was 5, I remember saying to my mom, "Okay, I just caught wind of this thought that the earth is moving, the earth is turning." And when you're 5, that's really hard. At least it was hard for me to figure out. So I said, "How can I tell? If it's moving, how can I tell?" She said, "Well, it's hard to tell because everything is turning at the same time." And what I did with that answer was to think, all right, everything must be upside down at the same time. And if we're all upside down at the same time, we don't know that we're upside down because we're all upside down. So I sat on the end of my bed and I hang on to it really tight. And I looked out the window and I watched my mailbox and I thought, when the mailbox goes upside down, I'm not going to go upside down, and then I'm going to know that it's not, that it's moving. And just recently I thought, Mayor, another kid would have gone into physics. And tried to figure out the laws of motion and stuff. But what I did was try to figure out, what do people mean when they say a thing a certain way? And so I'm kind of this self-appointed watchdog. What does that word feel like in me that you're using to describe that phenomena? A few years ago, NASA said they discovered what was causing the aurora borealis, the northern lights, and it was described plasma bullets exploding 2/3 of the way between the Earth and the moon. Well, I take issue with that. They don't look like bullets exploding. They don't feel like bullets exploding. They could have used a different language entirely, and that language sends a very specific message. So I can get really, up in arms about it. don't do that. But so that's, thank you for asking. I mean, I write a book about it one day. But I couldn't pinpoint one moment where I was like, oh, that's what I'm going to do. It gradually became, and I had all this stuff, all this information. And I'm bold enough and naive enough to think, okay, I'm going to do something with that.
Anybody else?
You mentioned that you have a program on public radio.
Yes.
Is that a regular thing?
Every Friday at 7:35 a.m. on Interlochen Public Radio. It won't be tomorrow because they're doing their fundraiser. And what I do is tell the stories in 5 minutes, you can't say a lot. And the guy that I do it with is very candid about not knowing anything about the night sky, so I have to script his question and my answer. So it's really fun to try to be spontaneous in that kind of an environment. Sometimes it works really well, sometimes it...
It's interesting to us. For years, people in the astronomy club have been documenting how dark the sky is.
Oh, yeah.
We actually have meters.
Yeah.
They're called the sky quality.
Yeah, yeah.
Meters.
That's, we had to use that for Headlands to get our qualification.
And after years, just so people in the room know, the city of Ann Arbor really is having an effect. Years ago, the city approached people in the astronomy club to help put together a dark sky ordinance. The city realized they couldn't put it into effect because they were their own worst offenders, mm-hmm. right? But the city has been really aggressive yeah. about reducing its own lighting. And over the years, out where I live, which is about 7 miles out, I'm about halfway to Peach Mountain off of Huron River Drive, and it has gotten darker. The sky has gotten darker.
Wonderful.
You know, numerically, we can see it on the meters. It's really wonderful that,
where
municipalities and government jurisdictions are really taking
not,
a stance.
Not every county, not every county has a lighting ordinance. Emmett County does have a lighting ordinance, and to get the dark sky designation, we had to have an ordinance specific to this piece of property that was more strict than the existing ordinance. And then also, right now, the IDA, their big thing, the International Dark Sky Association, which is located in Tucson, Arizona, their big push is that, all right, municipalities across the country now are having to make the transition to LED, and here is our moment to really talk about effective outdoor lighting, because it doesn't need to be shining up into the sky. It needs to be focused down on the thing that needs to be lit, and it needs to be gradual. We have really bright, hot light at night. It really diminishes our vision, whether you're walking or driving, and it really can be really dangerous. So not only for beautiful views of the night sky and to support telescopic views, but to really create more safe environments. I wrote a letter to the mayor's office in Detroit when I read a story about complaining that, you know, they had to turn the lights off because they didn't have any money. I said, you know, you ought to get really progressive about that. Instead of saying we had to turn the lights off, you figure out where you don't need so much light, and you navigate it that way. I didn't get a response. But I am working with the Department of Natural Resources because they've invested a lot of money in a building on the Detroit River called the Globe Building. This building is historically significant because this is where Henry Ford first saw a combustion engine. And so this building is being turned into an outdoor adventure center, kind of a gateway experience for children in the urban area to be introduced to the natural environment around Michigan and how they can get involved in that. And on the second floor, they will have a dark sky exhibit. And so I will be speaking, they've got like 15 people on this conference call to talk about how we can partner with the Headlands and really to begin to raise awareness around dark skies. So anywhere that we can do it, it's great. So there are, it's starting to show up in more and more places.
Actually, the ordinance is not in effect in Ann Arbor yet. It will be. And in the meantime, the university continues to install more and more of their fully lit globes, while the city is trying to reduce light in other places, but the city can't tell the university to stop installing the fully lit globes.
Yeah,
where the city has been converting them into half lit globes.
Well, we just keep raising the bar of awareness. Keep telling the story. Keep talking about it. And say, you know, you could be seeing the Pleiades tonight, but darn it, that light is in the way. Yeah, thank you for all that good work.
I just really wanted to thank you for your efforts. I wanted you to know how much it is incredibly appreciated.
Thank you.
You know, that, and especially to me, the concept, you know, light pollution, that, you know, we understand that. And then when they came out with the term light trespass,
yes.
I thought, yes, now you've really named it.
Yes, because, you know, it had Headlands. The number one question is, when can I see the northern lights? And the number two question is, what can I do about my neighbor's light? Mm-hmm. That's light trespass. If you've got somebody's light shining into your property or right into your bedroom window, mm-hmm. which is usually what's bothering people, mm-hmm. that's light trespass.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't let people trespass on property lines. We don't let a lot of things happen. But light that's spilling out, we don't do anything about it. It's just an issue that hasn't been thought about. I would like to recommend Paul Bogard's book, The End of Night. He got his degree in creative nonfiction writing. I never had heard of that before. He teaches at James Madison University. But he took it from the brightest place, Las Vegas, to the darkest place that he could find and wrote a book about his journey. And it goes through outdoor lighting. It goes through the research that's recently been done on the effects of artificial light at night on human beings. It's really well written and a wonderful resource if you want to get informed about the issue. And then if you go to the International Dark Sky Association website, they actually have sample letters that you can write to your neighbor, how to help them recognize that they're trespassing against you, and then even to your municipality to look at lighting issues.
This is a totally new concept, light trespass.
Yeah.
It was always assumed
that
if your neighbor wanted to shine brilliant lights, they, you know, you were just so out of luck.
Right, because they need to feel safe.
Yeah, well, it doesn't make them safer.
Right. No, so there was a really funny story that went around on the Internet last week, but I had heard this before, that research shows that prior to the end of the 1800s, human sleep patterns weren't what we think they are. You didn't go to bed and sleep 8 hours through and then wake up in the morning. There were two sleeps. So you go to bed at night for first sleep and then wake up sometime in the middle of the evening. And this would be a time for quiet contemplation or intimate relations or even cooking food, going visiting, and then come back for second sleep and get up at dawn. Now, doctors didn't start to hear about something that they tagged as insomnia until the introduction of electric light and artificial light at night, because what was happening then is people were staying up later, then they would go to bed, they would wake up between first and second sleep, but then they couldn't go back to sleep. And so this starts to show up, insomnia starts to show up right at the same time that the introduction of the artificial light. And then sleep ideas about sleep patterns totally changes. So we're 100 years away from that now. Now it's finally starting. Wow, this is what's going. It's the light. Because the light suppresses the production of melatonin, which is the thing that helps us drift into sleep. And also relaxes us so that we can, you know, the body can heal itself in that state. And that's being severely interrupted.
There used to be an amazing venue in Washington, D.C. called the Carter Baron Amphitheater. It was an outdoor amphitheater. Mm-hmm. It was on 16th Street. And there were no lights in there except little tiny, I think if they were red, you know, like to show you how to get to.
Yeah.
Even the concession stand was low lit.
Yeah.
And the bathrooms, I mean, there were no bright lights anywhere there. It was really incredibly magical. And as you sat outdoors and saw the concert, behind it you saw the woods in Rock Creek Park. And so, I mean,
there's a lot of good thinking people out there.
I don't know if it even exists anymore, but to me it was the most magical experience, you know, decades ago. It was just incredible to have this whole concert experience and to go around to normal places like a snack bar or a bathroom, and there's no bright lights anywhere. It was gorgeous and magical and incredible.
Yeah.
I hope, you know, what the heck happened to it, I don't know. But
there
should be maybe more thinking of that kind of thing.
Well, we can all think about it together. Yeah. We want that.
One more question? Okay.
Thanks for being so patient, everybody.
I just wondered if you have a story you tell orally for all of your sister's pictures here.
Yes, I mean, each one of these images comes from a specific fairy tale. So like over there, I've got Jack and the Beanstalk, and I told the story of the arrow to the sun, how the stars fell into the sky. And so the answer is yes. I don't know if you want a story right now, another story.
And if there's time.
Does anybody want another story? Another story? Okay, we'll end with a story. Let me think of a good one that I could tell. But I've written a fairy tale that goes with that, so not one that's illustrated here, but that we are creating a book out of it, and it goes like this. Once upon a time, there were two brothers who worked in the service of a mighty king. So mighty was the king that around the land he was known as the Sun King. He had rich gold furnishings and tapestries and fountains, but the Sun King wanted more. So he summoned the oldest brother, and he said, "It's not fitting that my palace should only face to the west. For this is the land of the setting sun. I would have a palace that faces east so that when the sun rises at dawn each day, he will know that he's entering my kingdom. Build me that palace." Well, the oldest brother had the gift of structure, and so he created a beautiful palace for the king. And all went well for a while, but the king wanted more. And he summoned the oldest brother again, and he said, "It's not fitting that my palace should reach only into the realm of man on earth alone. I would reach into the stars. Build me a palace to the stars so that the sun will know I lie in wait for him all night." So the oldest brother built a magnificent dome in which could be placed a machine that could scan and survey the sky all through the night so that the king could wait for the sun. Around this time, things began to get very cold, and a darkness began to creep throughout the kingdom, and the people began to lose the color and the warmth from their homes and their lives. Well, the Sun King didn't like this, and so he summoned the youngest brother who had the gift of proclamation, and he said, I want you to write me a proclamation to the sun. You tell the sun that it's not fitting that he should grow quiet now that I've built my palace facing to the east and my palace into the sky. I want him to know that I intend to rule his kingdom as well, and it's not fitting that he should grow cold now. Well, the youngest brother, he was a stargazer, and he had a great deal of star wisdom, and he said to the king, I can write that proclamation, but that might not be the best way to approach the sun. Well, the Sun King was enraged by this, and he said, I will have my proclamation, and you shall write it. So the youngest brother had an idea. He wrote the Sun King's proclamation, but he took his star wisdom and he hid it in riddles and in rhymes and in fairy tales that the Sun King just took for nonsense. The cold continued to creep throughout the kingdom. And eventually the Sun King grew older and he died. But there were many who still celebrated the riddles and the rhymes and the fairy tales of the youngest brother, and they were able to keep their warmth. But over time, they too forgot that these tales had hidden within them this star knowledge and this wisdom. Well, eventually, the king's palace was no longer suited to the life that came after him, and it was turned into a museum. And the brothers' nursery rhymes and riddles and tales were forgotten and just considered nonsense stories meant to entertain children. And then the story goes, that is, until now. The place where this star knowledge was hidden is a place that we know as the nursery rhymes of Mother Goose. And then it goes into the Mother Goose nursery rhymes, and the background of the story is that the Sun King is a direct reference to Louis XIV, who was regarded as the Sun King in France in the late 1700s and early 1800s. The two brothers are the brothers Claude and Charles Perrault. Claude Perrault was an architect, the older brother. He built the east colonnade of the Palace of the Louvre, and he also built the Paris Observatory, right on the Rose Line, or the Paris Meridian, which the French fought for to be the prime meridian for a long time, well into the 1900s, actually. And then his youngest brother, Charles, is the person who's historically given credit as being the innovator of the literary genre known as the fairy tale. And when he retired, he published a book called Tales of the Past with Morals, and the subtitle was Tales of Mother Goose. And it's from Charles Perrault that we get the stories Cinderella and Blackbeard, Little Red Riding Hood. He didn't necessarily create those stories. He was writing down the folk tales of his people. And so when you look into the Mother Goose nursery rhymes, you can find some of the stars hidden, at least if you're somebody like me who's willing to take a step in that direction. So in the calendar in May, we had the Hey Diddle Diddle Moon, and each piece in that particular nursery rhyme refers to the constellations that are overhead in the month of May, and you know that it's May because the cow jumps over the moon is a reference to the new moon in the sign of Taurus, the bull, which is in the cow family, you could say, and the dish is the tricky part. But what happens in the month of May is the Milky Way lies as flat around the horizon as it can get, and it seems to disappear or run away from our view. And while that's happening, the Big Dipper is directly overhead. This is the spoon. So the dish runs away with the spoon. The cat is Leo. The fiddle is the stringed instrument or the lyre. Lyra, the constellation. And the little dog is Canis Minor. Is that everybody? Hey, diddle, diddle, the cat and the fiddle. The cow jumped over the moon. The little dog laughed to see such a sport. And the dish ran away with the spoon. So you could imagine that this was a way to impart star knowledge to somebody. You're out, you know, maybe a farmer walking through a field and reciting a little ditty for a child so that they can always know what's happening overhead. These are beautiful ways to teach about the story. Thank you for the question, but I hope that was satisfying enough. So look for it. It's coming. I already have the cover of it, and it's called Higher Than a House, which is a reference to a nursery rhyme. Higher than a house, higher than a tree. Oh, what can you be? And the answer is, anybody? A star.
Thank you very much,
Thank
Mary.
You. Thanks so much for coming out and for braving the cold and for asking good questions. Thank you. And come and see us.